Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us for the latest Pediatric Insight Conversation brought to you by the Child Health Advisory Council and Career Physician. My name is Arnie Strauss. I'm the former chair of pediatrics at Vanderbilt in Cincinnati and a pediatric cardiologist. We have several council members in attendance who will be discussants in this and members of the leadership of Career Physician, including John Hayes, Wesley Milliken, Bruce Rubin, Bruder Stapleton, leader of our group, Craig Hillemeyer, Christine Gleason, and Valerie Opapari. Today's topic has to do with developing the infrastructure for doing clinical research in pediatrics. I think this is a key topic because of the need, as we all know, to continuously improve the way we care for patients. I've often suggested to my faculty and trainees that if I took care of patients the way we did when I was an intern, it would be a disaster. And so how have we learned how to make a difference and continue to improve? And it's through clinical research. So I'd like to begin this discussion with Chris Gleason and ask her to talk about what are the components of clinical research infrastructure that are needed to be successful in pediatrics. Dr. Gleason?
I think the first thing I'll say is that the components really don't fit. It's not like a one-size-fits-all approach. I think it's important for programs, institutes, hospitals, departments, et cetera, to look at their infrastructure around their goals. What is it that they, are they starting fresh? Are there engaged physicians who really want to do this work? Is there leadership to support it? Are you focusing on a community clinical research program, or is it going to be primarily hospital-based? And what's the existing infrastructure in whatever institute, school of medicine, and so forth? But once you've sort of decided what your fit is going to be and so forth, to me, the crucial component for a clinical research program is your clinical research coordinator, or whatever term is used for that person. It needs to be a rock star. It can make or break a program. If you have somebody who can work closely with the PI or PIs of your clinical research infrastructure, and who has dedicated administrative staff, regulatory staff to help that person, to help the PI, that will make a strong program. Data managers is sort of the second, or data analysis, whatever comes with your hospital, your department, your infrastructure, it's so important to have data management, not just to actually get the data managed and so forth, but how to educate those of us who are plunging into this realm and know we need a lot of support, but we also need to know what to do and how to put together a good proposal and how to get something, prepare documents for an IRB that relate to our data management. I think taking an entrepreneurial approach, I'm really curious to hear what the rest of you have had to say who've done this. It really is like running a business for those of us that have been involved in this realm.
Thank you, Chris. I would emphasize the both of those points. When I came here to Cincinnati, we had literally 300 clinical research coordinators, but our data management was outdated and actually not well certified, which is critical, so that, as you suggest, there can be quality control of the studies by those data managers. So in summary, your comments are that people are crucial parts of the infrastructure.
This is a very expensive endeavor to have high quality, well-trained, really knowledgeable individuals. And one of the things that I think departments can think about, Chris, I think you kind of mentioned it early on, you know, looking at the infrastructure across schools, colleges, and the hospital systems. But one of the important things I think you can also think about is how can you leverage that expertise and maximize how well it's deployed across divisions? So for my example, you know, at my department, we had a lot of really great expertise in key areas, but really thin in certain divisions. So we worked towards, you know, I'll use the word centralizing, but it really wasn't centralizing so much as coordinating the activities of the expertise across divisions to really leverage the expertise so that more individuals could be engaged in good, high quality clinical research without any of the detriments that comes from not having knowledgeable people helping you to design trials and effectuate the trials and meet all the regulatory requirements.
Yeah, that is what I meant by knowing what your existing infrastructure is, which may be throughout the medical school. It might not even be close to your department or whatever, or in different schools, you know, school of bioengineering and, you know, and so forth. So where you can find really good, really skilled people that you can connect with and build your program. I would also add that you can look at existing infrastructure that is through, if you are fortunate enough to be able to get into a network, an existing national or regional clinical research network, sometimes the components, especially if you're starting a research program, the components that come with that program can help you to establish something that's really strong in your own institution or your own department or division. So not necessarily within your own geographic area, but if you're part of a clinical research network or you join that to get started, that can come with some really important components that help you build your own infrastructure.
One of the things I also wanted to bring out is that not only do you need to look across your department to try and figure out how to bring all of those services to present the strongest research portfolio, but also across the university that you might be associated with, because there are oftentimes other departments in social services and social sciences that act or public health that might actually be able to supplement those things that you have. And then one of the things that sometimes people forget early on in putting together a research protocol is many of these research clinical research protocols do better if they have community involvement. And to try and set up and form a way to get input from the community into the research product is actually a way that oftentimes can improve your relationships with the community. And it's probably better to start that up front than to wait and sort of look at it as something that you've sort of forgot to do farther down the road.
And I very much agree with that and want to emphasize an example. So we had a study that involved Spanish speaking components of the community and recruiting Spanish speaking mothers to be the interviewers was highly successful and dramatically increased recruitment to the study. And we believe increased the quality of the data that was obtained because there was trust in those individuals. And that applies to many components of the community, as Greg implied, such as the African-American community or other groups that are so key to having actually representative data across the spectrum of the community. So I think that's, Greg, a very important point, involving the community upfront early to make sure that there's diversity in the data that's acquired. The second question, which has already been alluded to by a couple of people, has to do with how to develop those relationships outside of the department or even outside of the medical school for the key components of research infrastructure. And I know that Valerie has a lot of experience with this at the University of Michigan because of the great School of Public Health and other components of the university. So Dr. Opapari, if you could comment about those relationships and how to involve others throughout the university.
So I'm a firm believer in the real importance of taking advantage of and leveraging all the expertise across your broad community. There isn't any area of clinical, translational, or even basic science research in this day and age that doesn't involve multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary teams. And when you're on a university campus, I think one of your first opportunities should really be to try to learn as much as you can about that expertise that resides outside your department, while you're also gaining as much and deep, obviously, knowledge of the aspirations of the faculty and staff in your department. One of the ways you can do that is meeting with department chairs and division chiefs of key entities or deans of key schools and colleges on the campus and make an appointment to meet and greet and share some of the work that's going on in your community, but also seeking to find out really what the expertise is in those schools and colleges. And I think that it's that sharing of information that starts the first phase of what can potentially be possible. But it's going to require a little bit more than that. And I think what I would suggest is that there's a lot of different strategies one can use beyond the meet and greet and learning. And one of them that, you know, I'll suggest is actually using whatever small amounts of pilot funds you might have available. So for instance, we started a proposal with the School of Public Health where the biostatics expertise at that school had a lot of master's level, PhD levels, biostatisticians, and clinical design experts. They actually run a master's and graduate program in the design of clinical trials. And we put up a very nominal amount of money and said, you know, we'd like this expertise to come and do office hours on our campus. And faculty and staff could sign up with their projects and their questions and their ideas and get some real expertise in the early phase of design. It was a great opportunity for us to, again, create some synergies across the schools and colleges. And that program actually turned into a full-time entity and effort with the School of Public Health that was funded off of eventual grants that were obtained through that kind of collaboration. Another example I would throw out is, you know, most of us have research days, opportunities where we highlight the expertise of our faculty and staff. A very simple way to encourage graduate students from other schools and colleges to get involved is to have, you know, awards that you give out for undergraduate, graduate level, master's level, PhD students who are working in collaborative interdisciplinary projects. Another thing I'll throw out, you know, just to get the topic kind of going, there's a number of things that come to my mind, but joint recruitments. You know, when you understand the interests and the needs of another school or college or another unit within the medical school, you can seriously start to think about, well, what kind of a recruitment could we do jointly together that would fill your need, but at the same time, fill a need in my area? And similarly, in addition to, you know, proactive joint recruitments from the, you know, from the beginning phase of a search, I think you can also reach out and offer an opportunity for joint appointments for individuals who've demonstrated a really strong commitment to interdisciplinary research with your community. It sends a huge message to others that there are real opportunities for us to collaborate and to build programs together. And I think some of these strategies, you know, can be really useful as examples of, you know, how to reach out, how to make contacts, and how to really spur up interest in creating some programs that are jointly owned and supported.
Thank you, Valerie. I couldn't agree more and really want to emphasize the idea of pilot programs and joint recruitments. I think most of us realize that the School of Medicine tends to have substantial financial resources over and above what many of the other schools might have, and that protecting the time of people, faculty in those schools can be very helpful because they have such a substantial teaching load often. And so it's those kinds of interactions really moat the research and take advantage of expertise. And I also think faculty from other schools love getting involved with patients and doing the kind of work that will change the outcome. So I think it's a really winning formula for both kinds of entities. Obviously, you mentioned biostatisticians, but some of the key components that I have also thought about are epidemiology, of course, in the School of Public Health, but also informatics. And I think that's such a key component of study design, being able to both recruit and describe the results of a clinical study is having the right informatics support. And those often are in other schools, or the expertise is often in other schools. So those kinds of interactions are both at substantial places like Michigan, but even at smaller colleges can be extremely helpful. So I wanted to move on to the third kind of issue is How to fund. Valerie, do you want to comment again?
You mentioned teaching, and I think it's worth us taking just a couple minutes to talk about that, because it is a complex topic. As most people, I'm sure, who watch this webinar know, or they may learn from this webinar, in schools and colleges outside of the School of Medicine, the teaching is generated through tuition dollars, and those are very precious. And most schools and colleges are very reticent to encourage faculty teaching because it could undermine the financial well-being of a school of public health, a department of mathematics, a school of informatics, and so on. But I would offer that that is also a strategy that we found worked extraordinarily well when we as a department encouraged and offered and tried to really develop teaching opportunities for our faculty in those schools and colleges, where they could take their clinical research expertise and go and teach epidemiology course in the School of Public Health, you know, a nominal amount of time, not request any tuition dollars, but provide an opportunity again for the students to learn about some of the work that's being done in the medical school. And that reaped huge benefits in terms of getting undergraduates and graduate students who reached out to our faculty around opportunities to participate in some of the research work that was going on, as well as opportunities for interdisciplinary faculty-led research connectivity that wouldn't have occurred if we hadn't made that possible. So I'm glad you mentioned the teaching opportunity. My only caveat would be that, you know, when you're encouraged to try to get the tuition dollars, maybe you should put that on the back burner, because there's many, many other great benefits from that kind of interactivity that the nominal amount of money that you get from the tuition for giving a 1 hour lecture, you know, four times a year, are offset by the huge benefits that you get from the visibility from those opportunities.
You mentioned joint appointments going one way, that is joint appointments for people from other schools in the College of Medicine or in the Department of Pediatrics, but it goes the other way too. So having Department of Pediatrics faculty have a joint appointment or an affiliated appointment, but another school helps bring those teaching times and interactions to the fore, and potentially brings masters, especially master's level students, to the Department of Pediatrics and Children's Hospital to bring their expertise and time and effort to a clinical research study. And so we found that extremely helpful.
One of the things that I might bring up, Barney, at this point is that as you reach out across the university to other departments, at perhaps outside the School of Medicine, it's important to pay a little bit of attention to the fact that they have a different culture than many of the departments within the School of Medicine. And it's important to realize it's a two-way street. You have things that you need to have done for your research, and you need to find out what's important for them in terms of what they need to get out of the relationship. Because as I think, Valerie pointed out, sometimes a small involvement around one particular project can lead to a much larger involvement in either future projects, joint recruitments. And it's important to understand that other departments within the university might value other things more than you do. And you need to understand that and have clear expectations up front.
I couldn't agree more. And the culture is different. And the rewards for those faculty can be somewhat different. Even what we might consider a modest publication record can be a huge benefit to faculty and other schools. So one of the key issues in doing clinical research and developing the research infrastructure is money. Dr. Stapleton has tremendous expertise in this field because of his many years being a leader in the department. So Bruder, how do we fund the clinical research infrastructure?
Well, everyone on this call has been the creator of funding for their faculty and their faculties. And you have to be nimble, every chair and every division chief. It's really not a simple answer, because, you know, there is the issue of funding the recruit themselves, you know, establishing how to recruit a top clinical investigator. And often the sources of funding for all clinical research is internal and external. The internal sources, obviously, as you recruit clinician scientists, clinical investigators, it's helpful to align them with key strategic goals of the hospital. So the hospital is often willing to support recruitment of clinical investigators aligned with the strategic goals of the hospital. Departments have a vice chair of research almost uniformly, and those individuals are very knowledgeable about the resources both in the hospital and the department and at the university. Institutional resources are often available through the CTSA, and we took great advantage of aligning our clinical investigators with, and we had great programs to mentor people on submitting IRBs, study design, mock study sections. I mean, there's a lot of resources that you don't have to come up with as a chair if they're available in the institution through a CTSA, even the K2 grants. The other source is philanthropy. Philanthropic donors really resonate with clinical research. It's something they know. They hear from their friends. They understand the impact of a disease or a problem. And so philanthropy and endowed chairs have been very helpful in funding clinical research. And then there are disease societies. We have worked like the Society of Juvenile Rheumatoid Arthritis and Cystic Fibrosis to, if you have an opportunity to advance the field by supporting a clinical investigator in their area, they often may partner with you to recruit. And then there's also ways to tag on to multicenter studies. I know the peanut study that Sandra Jewell ran had several ancillary projects that really supported clinical research. And the CKID studies that I'm familiar with in the NIDDK has a number of great opportunities for ancillary. There's funding in those ancillary, those very comprehensive studies that already have the infrastructure. So being able to tag onto those is a great way. So, you know, I think department reserves, division reserves, the aligning with the children's hospitals or the hospital's strategic goals, knowing, as everyone said, what's available on the campus. I mean, a CTSA can be very helpful in bringing people on board, and then knowing the community, not just the donors, but also the people who are in disease-oriented societies, and then looking for foundations and NIH comprehensive studies. So you don't have to build those are valuable because you don't have to build the total infrastructure, COG, other things. Those are the things that strike me. And you just have to be nimble, and you sort of don't have a simple funding mechanism that's the same for everybody.
So the last topic I wanted to address briefly has to do with involving all of the faculty from all departments within, for example, a children's hospital. So Bob, might you comment on how to do that in particular in relationship to surgery?
The tactics, strategies that were previously discussed are all really applicable to those busy clinical services like surgery. You know, sometimes I felt like we had to remind, especially hospital leaders, that faculty were at a children's hospital because they wanted to advance the field, and they didn't want to just be busy clinicians. Yes, they like to be busy clinically, but they really do want to be participants in this. So the dilemma is always, you know, as Bruder mentioned, funding. So I think it becomes really imperative for surgeons and other busy clinicians to leverage the tactics that you all addressed about the relationships with others. Collaboration becomes key. You know, one of the specific tactics that I've seen that has been really successful, some departments of surgery, for example, have actually hired their own basic or translational PhDs who can then partner with clinicians, because a lot of translational scientists are looking for, forgive the non-human term of, you know, research substrate, right? They're looking for patients to extrapolate their findings in the laboratory. So that's an opportunity for surgeons to become partners in translational research, bringing their clinical experience to that research. The other thing I wanted to really highlight. Valerie was being a little modest, I think, because Michigan and Stanford come to mind as two institutions that have been very successful at developing centers of innovation by having the business school, the engineering school, the medical school actually formalize collaborations that become kind of incubators for product development and other innovations. And as I mentioned, I know one of the pediatric surgeons at Michigan has developed a whole company based on some of that partnership. And Stanford has generated multiple such products. So it's really key for surgeons to find partners, because they're just not going to typically have the time and the resources to do NIH-funded research. It's really, I think all the ideas that were discussed previously by the group are really imperative for surgeons and other busy clinicians. I will just add one other challenge that I saw frequently, and that was the competition for a busy clinician's time. It's a little harder to say, you know, Monday is your research day. And so the collaborators with whom clinicians collaborate need to be really flexible and available. And that's a skill that not all researchers have. So those the right individuals are needed for those partnerships to be successful.
Yeah, well, I want to thank Bob for making the mention about the work with the business school and the other schools that have led to startup companies. And you know, that's very true of a number of places. And, you know, we can all be very proud of those kind of contributions to our fields. But what does a small department do that doesn't have a large business school and doesn't have an incubator, you know, three state funded incubator unit for startups across the Midwest? And I'd offer one example that I think has really been very effective at the grassroots level at Michigan. And that is, we've encouraged our multidisciplinary clinical teams, when they do their clinical case conferences, to spin off once a month, once every 6 weeks, an extra half hour, 40 minutes for the fellows and the young faculty with the senior faculty to talk about potential collaborative research projects that take advantage of the rich clinical material that are at all of our children's hospitals. How can we learn more and add more to the literature based on what we're doing here and what we're seeing and how we're managing things? You would be amazed at how quickly that those kind of discussions can turn into providing an oncology fellow and a surgical fellow an opportunity to think really hard about X, Y, or Z, or a neonatologist with a perinatal expert to think about X, Y, or Z. And they can often really turn into great, you know, research programs, you know, at a small level, but I've seen many of them turn into program projects and turn into R01 funded research programs. So I really think it's important for us to emphasize that you can try a lot of strategies at the local level, at a really, you know, short startup. This is an idea, test it out, see if you can get engagement that really can lead to some good clinical research. And, you know, for those of us that have these wonderful other infrastructures, it behooves us to take advantage of them, but not every center has that. And yet I think they can really contribute very effectively in this domain.
Thank you, Valerie. And thank you all for your comments. So just to briefly summarize, I think developing our clinical research infrastructure and funding it starts with people. As Chris said at the beginning, it starts with quality clinical research coordinators, data management personnel, and others. The second key point is that interactions within the university or within with other departments of a school of medicine really are a huge advantage for the Department of Pediatrics to develop, run clinical research efforts. And those resources can be leveraged through faculty interactions as well as student interactions. So people taking advantage of being part of a university. And then understanding cultures, I think, was mentioned as a key component of those interactions, whether that's basic scientists or with biostatisticians, for example. It's really crucial to understand how others can benefit from the interaction that also leads to productive clinical research. And as Bruder mentioned, funding has to be from a variety of sources, but leveraging people's time can really help move clinical research forward. And I would just add at the end that obviously we need to continue to do clinical research, to study the procedures and medications and processes that we use to make sure that they benefit our patients and to make sure that they're done in a way that is both ethical and of high enough quality that the data are convincing, the results are convincing. So thank you all very much. And I hope that this has been helpful to those of you who are listening to this Pediatric Insight conversation. There are other such insights at the Career Physician website. We urge our listeners, our viewers to go to those and add to the understanding of how to do clinical research. Thank you.